From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Annie Dillard is best known for her meditations on nature and the process of writing. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her book Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. On today's Fresh Air, Dillard reads from her new book, her first novel, and talks with us about her life. Also today, I was a communist for the FBI. I married a communist. And other pop relics from the Cold War. We talk with Michael Barson, author of a new book about how pop culture fueled Cold War hysteria. And book critic John Leonard reviews Studs Terkel's new book, Race, How Blacks and Whites Think and Feel About the American Obsession. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. More towns and cities came under the control of Mujahideen guerrillas as fighting continued in Afghanistan today. A UN envoy brought in to mediate the situation says deposed President Najibullah is still in the country, despite earlier reports that he'd be flown to India. Chris Bowers filed this report for the BBC.
Mr. Savan is still refusing to confirm consistent reports that Dr. Najibullah has taken refuge inside a UN office in the capital. He said the situation was extremely sensitive and that negotiations to fly the former president out of the country were continuing. Earlier, senior figures in the ruling party said an agreement had been reached between themselves, the UN, and the coalition in control of the airport. Mr. Savan refused to be drawn, and sidestepping further questions on the fate of Dr. Najibullah, went on to make an emotional plea for restraint. The head of the powerful Islamic Jihad Council, Commander Ahmad Shah Massoud, whose forces control much of the country, has called for a Mujahideen government rather than an impartial transition council originally envisaged by the UN. The special envoy said the United Nations was not specifically attached to any one idea, and if the Afghans wanted a Mujahideen government, that was their choice.
Chris Bowers in Kabul. Serbian militia forces captured another town in the northern part of Bosnia-Herzegovina today. The Serbs have now captured five important towns in the northern part of Bosnia along the Serbian border. As they did in neighboring Croatia, Serbian forces and the Serbian-dominated Federal Army appear to be seizing territory in the newly independent republic with the aim of uniting it with Serbia. Serbia has rejected the independence of Bosnia, which has about 60% of Yugoslavia's arms industry. Downtown Chicago slowly picked up life as usual today following an unexpected week's vacation caused by a subterranean flood. Many businesses closed after a system of underground freight tunnels filled with water from the Chicago River. Michael Leland of member station WBEZ reports.
Downtown Chicago's landmark Marshall Field store reopened this morning. Field's president Dan Skoda says customers won't notice much that's different from before the flood, except for a lack of hot water and the mannequins in the store window.
Well, all we did was keep the same mannequins and give them some brooms and buckets, so we're trying to enjoy this as much as we can.
Chicago City Hall is also open today for the first time in a week. 11 buildings in the city's loop are still closed, awaiting work to restore their electricity. Crews from the Army Corps of Engineers began pumping out the flooded 60-mile underground tunnel system shortly after midnight. The work is being done slowly to prevent damage to the tunnels. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Leland in Chicago.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 30 points to close at 3,336. Declines led advances by a margin of nearly 3-1 in heavy trading. This is NPR. American, European, and Japanese business groups have joined in an effort to pressure the United States and the European community to resolve their dispute over farm export subsidies. Negotiations on reforming world trade, known as the GATT talks, have been stalled for more than a year because of the dispute. On Wednesday, President Bush is set to discuss the issue with the head of the European Commission and the president of the EC. That meeting is likely to be confrontational because all three leaders are under domestic political pressure not to compromise. Agricultural trade accounts for only 10% of world trade, but it's holding up agreements on vital issues such as textile quotas, patent protection, and world banking rules. As many as 100 cars may have been involved in a chain reaction collision in central Virginia. At least three people were killed and more than a dozen injured in the pileup. Rick Mattioni of member station WVTF reports the accident occurred on one of Virginia's most dangerous highways.
The accident occurred on Interstate 64 in the Afton Mountain area west of Charlottesville. That area is known for its problems with fog and other weather-related conditions. Fog is so dangerous on the mountain that an innovative photo-responsive lighting system was built into the road, making the busy interstate highway look like an airport runway during foggy conditions. Police say it may be late in the evening before they are able to clean up the accident scene. Rescue and police departments from five counties have personnel on the scene. Those injured in the chain reaction accident have been taken to three area hospitals. For National Public Radio, I'm Rick Mattioni in Roanoke, Virginia.
Blues musician Johnny Shines died today in an Alabama hospital. He was 76. Shines was known as one of the last of the original Mississippi Delta blues guitar players and singers. He was born in Tennessee but grew up in Mississippi, where he played with blues pioneers like Robert Johnson. He later moved to Chicago, where he was an innovator of the electric blues guitar. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Annie Dillard won a Pulitzer Prize in 1975 at the age of 29 for her first book, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. The book has been described both as a nature study and a series of poetic religious essays. She wrote this meditative book while living near a creek in a valley in Virginia's Blue Ridge Mountains. She said, "I am no scientist. I explore the neighborhood to view the landscape, to discover at least where it is that we have been so startlingly set down if we can't learn why." She's since written books about her childhood and the process of writing. Now Dillard has written her first novel. It's called The Living, and it's about the pioneers who settled the Northwest frontier. Here's a reading from the opening.
The sailor put down the helm, and Ada Fishburne felt the boat round up towards the forest. She stood in the bow, a supple young woman wearing a brown shawl and a deep-brimmed sunbonnet that circled her face. She carried her infant son, Glee, in her arms. Without a sound, the schooner slipped alongside a sort of dock that met the water from the beach. This dock represented the settlement on Bellingham Bay. Ada Fishburne had been sailing in Puget Sound and along this unbroken forest every day for almost a week. The same forest grew on the islands they passed, too. The trunks rose straight. She had seen enough of this wall of forest to know that even when the sun and all the sky shone full upon it, and the blinding sea glinted up at it, it was always dark. From behind her on deck, Ada heard her older son, Claire, singing a song. Claire was five, a right big boy for five, long in the leg bones like his father, and life suited him very well, and he found his enjoyment. She glanced back and saw her husband, Rooney, moving their four barrels, their five crates, their four kegs, and the rolled feather bed to the rail. Young Claire climbed up on everything barefoot as fast as Rooney set it down on the deck. Rooney tied the two cows and gave the ropes to Claire to hold, and the boy sang to them, half dead as they were. Neither man nor boy glanced up to see where he was getting off, which was a mercy, one of few, for she herself scarcely minded where she was, since she lost her boy Charlie on the overland road. But she hated to see Rooney downhearted when he had staked his blessed being on this place, and look at it. Ada and Rooney hauled their possessions off the dock. The baby Glee stayed asleep, moving its lips, and missed the whole thing. The schooner sailed on north and left them there.
Annie Dillard, this is your first novel. What came over you to write a novel?
It just come over me, Al. I'd written a short story in 1977 about just these same people, two men, Puget Sound, a threat of death, the big forest. And it interested me more than anything I'd ever written, and I'd always wanted to go back to it and, as it were, flesh it out a bit, and I fleshed it out to the tune of 600-some pages.
When you say go back to it, I mean, you're literally going back not only to that story but back in time. What interests you about setting a story in the past, about writing about a time that is not your own time?
I don't find these times very interesting. I'd just soon be in the 19th century.
Why?
People read more.
Well, I'm sure you still read a lot anyways. I doubt the century is holding you back from reading. What are the other reasons why you just assume live in the 19th century?
Well, I do like the antibiotics, but popular culture doesn't much interest me. And so to avoid popular culture in what you write, you either have to go back or you have to go in very, very, very deep or ignore it. And I have to live in the modern world, which is quite enough of it for me. So in my imaginative life, I just as soon check out.
So did you feel you had to find a language of the past? I mean, I find your language to be not a contemporary language in this book.
What a wonderful question. That was the most fun about writing the whole thing. I deliberately read no book that was written after, at the beginning, 1855, and then as I went on, 1893, the 1880s, while I was writing about that, in order to try to keep my language completely pure without any possible trace of anachronism. And of course, picked up phrases right and left from everything that I was reading, all sorts of little subtle things. For instance, in the 19th century, you would never say a group of people. You would always say a company of people. And a beautiful woman was called striking. They rarely used the word beautiful. And her bosom, essentially, was called her throat. What a beautiful throat this woman has. Meaning,
oh, is that what throat used to mean?
Yeah, meaning, boy, does she look good in that low-cut dress. Uh-huh. But after a while, I developed a kind of sense for what I needed to look up. So I wrote, of course, with a number of reference books all around me. And at one point I thought, I wonder if I can use camouflage as a verb, writing about the 19th century. And I looked up camouflage, and come to find out, you can't use camouflage, period, not as a verb or as a noun, until World War I. It came about in France in World War I.
The characters in your novel, The Living, are settlers. Could you imagine life as a settler yourself? Do you think you would have liked it?
Essentially, in some ways, I lived the life of a settler for parts of four or five years, on an island in Puget Sound, because we had not only no electricity, which is nothing, and no running water, which also proves to be nothing. I thought this would be terribly difficult, but in fact, you spend much less time on the fussing in life than you do when you have those things. But above all, we had no telephone or even radio link with the mainland. There was no link at all. They invited me to the Carter. There was no link at all except the mailboat, which came three times a week on the other side of the island, which was an hour and a half walk across pastures. They invited me to speak at Carter's inauguration. And by the time I got the boat in the water, when I next needed to go to the next land over and get milk for the children, and could get to a phone, by that time I almost was tempted to say, what inauguration? It was all so far away, so terribly far away.
And you liked that?
I liked it just fine. It got awfully dull. We used to, one fellow there got the New York Times, the Sunday New York Times, and would have a party every Sunday morning, and we'd have shirred eggs, which he baked on his wood stove, and little drinks, and we would read the Sunday New York Times, only none of us ever mentioned that it was last Sunday's New York Times, which had come in the mail on the Friday before.
But it didn't matter, because it was also far away anyway.
Exactly, yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Annie Dillard. In your book, The Writing Life, you wrote that the life of the writer is colorless to the point of sensory deprivation. This explains why so many books describe the author's childhood. A writer's childhood may well have been the occasion of his only firsthand experience. Did you feel that way about your own life when you were writing about writing?
Yeah. I had written a memoir that ended when I was 17, and my publisher said, well, why don't you write the next stage of it? And the reason is because I didn't do anything except sit in a room for the next 20 years messing up little pieces of paper.
So, and now do you feel like you have more of a life?
Oh, no. No, I really wasn't interested in having a life. I finished my book, and I really don't know what to do with myself, and I'm trying real life and finding it wanting. It doesn't seem to add up. Every day just passes and is gone. But when you're writing, every day is another two pages, and that adds up to something, crummy as those may be. On the other hand, there's a sort of selfish, solipsistic absorption to it, which is wearying. And so as soon as you finish writing a book, you want to go rushing out and save the world and help people and stuff.
I was wondering how being a mother affected your sense of not having any firsthand experience because you're always in a room writing.
Yeah, there's enough of that. There's enough of that every day. No, I would write only 3 or 4 hours a day.
But I mean, has being your being a mother changed your relationship to everyday life? You're kind of like forced to take part in it when you have a young child.
Yeah, it makes you more normal. On the other hand, I've been a mother for a heck of a long time because my youngest stepkid is 22 now, and I got her when she was 7.
Oh, I see. Let me ask you about your childhood. You were born in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Affluent family. Your family owned American Standard?
Oh, my parents didn't, no, but...
Your great-great-great...
grandfather or something founded it, yes.
And what was the company?
Yeah, American Standard.
I mean, what did they do?
Brass plumbing and fitting. It started out, and then it became just regular old plumbing. They've been involved in price-fixing scandals steadily ever since with Crane and the other major plumbing companies. It's a totally corrupt industry, as far as I can tell.
So was your father in the business?
Yep.
And were you interested in business when you were growing up?
No, neither was he. He quit and went down the Mississippi by himself in a boat and then fooled around being an actor and making radio spots and so forth for the rest of his life. He was not interested in it at all. He was a great romantic and still is.
So there was enough family money that he didn't feel he needed a job, a 9-to-5 job.
Yeah, I guess you finally hit what's too personal. Family money, for Christ's sake. That's really no subject for conversation. He worked 9-to-5.
Oh, I was thinking when he was traveling down a raft in the Mississippi or whatever you said, was not working 9-to-5.
Right. No, you're right. He took a few months off.
Okay. As a teenager, you wrote your minister a letter saying that you were quitting the church. What did the letter say?
Gosh, I have no idea. It was probably pretty bold.
Why did you quit?
Oh, it was a Presbyterian church in Pittsburgh, and I was a kid, and I thought I knew the Bible well enough to damn these people to hell, chapter and verse. Here they were in their minks and so forth. And they were the owners of, you know, of Pittsburgh industry and old money and banks and so forth. And I thought I was morally superior to these people, who, it turned out, of course, I realized as I grew up, had suffered enormously and had their private lives and had their private relation with God, and I knew nothing about it whatsoever.
Now, your father said to you, and you write about this in your memoir, your father said to you, didn't you realize that some people did these kinds of things quietly, no fuss? He thought you were trying to humiliate your parents by taking this grand gesture by you know, writing the letter and giving it to the minister.
I was a trial to those people, yeah. I also got in a drag race and got myself fingerprinted and on the front page of the paper and all that. Yeah, I was a constant trial to these people who were trying to live fairly discreetly.
Oh, right, and you were rebellious?
You bet.
Now, you later described yourself as a wanderer with a background in theology and a penchant for quirky facts. What is your background in theology?
Oh, I took a lot of theology at college, quite a lot. And then when I finished college, I was married, living in Virginia, and not doing a daggone thing except playing pinochle and softball all the time. And so I set about trying to educate myself, and one of the fields in which I read was theology.
Do you think of yourself as a religious person?
You bet.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, pure and simple.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I converted to Catholicism 2 years ago.
For example. Right. Have you found a church where you live that you like a lot?
I like a church on a college campus where you can go in your blue jeans and take communion and get out of there in 20 minutes. But what I really like best is a church where you're traveling, where you can go into some place in Tahiti or... Greenland or something and just be anonymous.
What do you like about the anonymity?
Well, otherwise it becomes just another social meeting. But when you're anonymous, you're just a person standing for people praying to your God.
Mm-hmm.
The prayer of all the people. What the hell is going on? Whatever your prayer is, you're representing the people.
You got married for the first time at the end of your sophomore year in college, which, I don't know, strikes me as pretty young, though.
It's okay. Struggle not. No, this doesn't bother me at all.
Okay.
Anything but money.
You got married at the end of your sophomore year in college, and I think the man that you married was a teacher of yours.
That's right, Richard Dillard.
Was he an English teacher?
You bet.
That strikes me as a kind of problematic, challenging thing to do because when you marry someone, you want to feel like you have a fairly equal relationship. But when you start off in a relationship where one person's the teacher and one person's the student, is it hard to overcome that in the personal part of your life?
No, it was no problem at all. I loved what he had to teach me. And he didn't know anything about women.
So you could teach him about that.
That's right.
Were your parents upset that you got married before you finished college?
No, because I continued to finish college.
Oh, you stayed in school?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And then I went on and got a master's and so forth, worked for the poverty program. No, it didn't interrupt my education at all. In fact, it enhanced it enormously. Because it turns out when you get married, you have absolutely nothing to do. All your friends are busy staying up all night, having a good time, and dating boys, and you're doing none of those things. So you're just doing your work like a good girl, and you do very well.
In your book, The Writing Life, you wrote that the fanaticism of your 20s shocks you now. What were the symptoms of your fanaticism when you were in your 20s?
Oh, gee. I thought that in order to save myself for literature, there were a number of things in which I could not engage. Entertaining, dressing, combing my hair. On the other hand, I could play all sorts of softball and pinochle and so forth and go dancing and tell jokes and play chess and play anagrams and so forth. But I was determined not to become a lady because I saw that becoming a lady was the big trap. Becoming a lady was the big trap.
Huh. What did becoming a lady mean? How did you define that?
Being well-groomed with good clothes and a beautiful house.
So this is like your mother's version of becoming a lady.
I wouldn't blame her for that. I was young.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But so I guess what I'm trying to figure out if it was growing up that you wanted to resist, or a certain version of being a lady that you wanted to resist.
Both of those things, and I still want to resist growing up. I've been a grown up now for some time, and I don't find anything in it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Annie Dillard. She has a new novel called The Living, and her other books include An American Childhood, The Writing Life, and Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, for which she won a Pulitzer Prize. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Writer Annie Dillard is my guest. Is it ever hard for you to figure out what to write about?
Oh, it's impossible. I can't ever figure out what to write about. I just spent, my last idea was in 1977 when I had an idea for a short story that I've just finally enlarged a bit. I can't think of ideas.
That's a problem for a writer.
Many writers seem to have book after book just back there waiting in mind, but I sure don't.
Well, how do you try to get inspiration when you're looking for an idea?
Well, I just read and read and try to pay attention to the world and try to pay attention to what I love about the world that other people don't seem to love or notice. But none of that works. I don't know. Every little book I've written seems to have had a different genesis, and there's nothing to be learned from it. I have no idea in the world how to get ideas. I read all of Boccaccio one time thinking, well, I will find one of these stories and do something with it. And it didn't do anything for me at all. I have no idea.
Well, you know, one of your books, The Writing Life, is about the process of writing.
Yeah.
Was that during a period when you didn't know what to write about, so you figured you might as well write about writing itself?
What it was... purely was working myself up, womping myself up to write The Living, which I knew was going to be an enormous effort. And it was a sort of private act of dedication, which I wish I'd kept private. I'm very sorry I published that book.
What?
Oh, it's not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I was going to work myself into a froth about how difficult and time-consuming this was going to be, I could have done that in my closet without going public with my little miseries. It's a funny book. It's funny as all get out. But other than that, I wish I'd kept it to myself.
How personal do you feel comfortable getting in your own writing? How far do you feel you go in revealing yourself?
Those are very different questions. I've never written personally at all, and yet people think that I do only because by writing about the world with such apparent, what they call intensity, you reveal a lot. You know, if you talk to somebody about your parents or your childhood or something, you don't really get to know that other person, nor that other person get to know you so well as if you go to a museum together or a zoo. The thing is to react to the world, and that's how you reveal yourself. And apparently there's a lot of reactions to the world and therefore a lot of revealing. But I've never written about my life or what my dearest concerns are, not even in my memoir, not a bit.
Why not?
Well, it's just not what I'm about. There are all sorts of writers here, and I do what I do, and others do what they do. It's not a moral issue. It's just that's not what I do. That's not what I'm here to write about.
Mm-hmm. How old were you when you won the Pulitzer Prize for A Pilgrim at Tinker Creek?
I must have been 30, or just about to turn 30. I guess I was 29. I started the book when I was 27.
Now, was that an ambition for you? Were you the kind of writer who felt, I'm going to prove that I could do it, I'm going to get that award?
Not in the least. I was in an academic setting. I was leading a life of essentially reading poetry and theology exclusively. I thought it would be wonderful to be published. That was certainly my highest ambition.
But winning the award wasn't a big deal?
At the time, it seemed to come after so much fuss and so many very disturbing trips to New York and the introduction, my introduction to a world that I didn't know existed, that it just seemed like one more thing to be dealt with. And I heard so much nonsense in connection with it. People called me, the press called me, I guess, and said, not my publisher, I mean the newspaper world called me and said, what are you doing right now as you hear that you have won the Pulitzer Prize? And I said, I'm washing spinach. And they said, don't you know that this means you need never wash spinach again? And I thought and probably said, sure I do. I don't like sand in my spinach. And I've been washing spinach ever since, and I think about it ever since. Did they think I was going to go hire a maid? I love to cook.
You mentioned these disturbing trips to New York. What kind of trips? Why were they disturbing?
There was a whole world full of people out there that thought that one wrote in order to move to Manhattan, in order to make a literary name for oneself, in order to get a table at Elaine's, all sorts of things that I'd never heard of in my life. I was living very purely with academic people who were reading the 19th century, essentially. And I was just utterly shocked. I'd been living there for 12 years in a wonderful, beautiful campus in Virginia, and I didn't know that this world existed. And was horrified. And I was young enough that when people misunderstood my motives, it upset me. But I'm coming up 47, but I don't care about those things now at all. I've completely come to terms with it. I found the Pulitzer Prize very useful for renting houses. unsurpassed for renting houses. Suddenly you don't need a security deposit. Suddenly everybody wants to have you there. And it's wonderful for that. And it's very nice for your publisher who's believed in you also. It's very nice.
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Annie Dillard, and her new book is her first novel, and it's called The Living. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Better Dead Than Red. We talk to Michael Barson. His new book looks at how pop culture fueled public hysteria during the Cold War, with everything from movies like I Was a Communist for the FBI to Red Menace bubblegum cards. And book critic John Leonard reviews Studs Terkel's new book, Race, How Blacks and Whites Think and Feel About the American Obsession. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. The State Department has denied a report that the United States gave Saudi Arabia unofficial permission to make three illegal arms transfers, including one to Iraq. We have a report from NPR's Neil Conan.
According to the Los Angeles Times, Saudi Arabia transferred U.S. bombs to Iraq in 1986, then last year let Gulf War allies Syria and Bangladesh take U.S.-made equipment home with them after the war was over. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher today confirmed that transfers did take place, inadvertently, he said, but he insisted that there was no U.S. policy to wink and nod at the deals. He also said that Congress had been promptly informed of the violations, that the Saudis had been reminded of their obligations under the Arms Export Act, and that the Saudis had said that they would ensure that this would not happen again. The State Department spokesman would not specify exactly what U.S.-made equipment was involved. According to the newspaper report, Iraq received Mark 84 2,000-pound bombs, while Syria and Bangladesh got U.S. trucks and armored vehicles. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
An Indian news agency says the Afghan government has agreed to let ousted President Najibullah leave the country. Najibullah is expected to seek asylum in India. Meanwhile, Mujahideen groups surround the capital of Kabul. One rebel group is threatening to attack the city unless the government steps down. But another key rebel leader, Ahmad Shah Massoud, says his forces will protect the capital. Massoud plans to form an interim governing council made up of Mujahideen groups. Preparations for California's first execution in 25 years are underway at this hour in San Quentin Prison, just north of San Francisco. The prison was put on full lockdown early today in anticipation of the execution of convicted murderer Robert Alton Harris. NPR's Isabel Alegria reports.
Prison officials say the mood among the inmates here is solemn as the hour draws closer for Robert Alton Harris's execution by lethal gas. This morning, Harris ordered his final meal, Kentucky Fried Chicken, jelly beans, and Pepsi, and went to a special room to visit with family members, where he is expected to remain until 6 p.m. when he will be transferred to a holding cell to await his execution. Officials say prison personnel are logging Harris's mental and spiritual condition every 15 minutes, and he will be under a psychiatrist supervision throughout the evening. Meanwhile, attorneys for the ACLU say they will ask the full federal appeals court to review their suit challenging California's use of lethal gas, an execution method they say violates the Constitution's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. At San Quentin Prison, I'm Isabel Alegria reporting.
Anti-abortion protests got off to a slow start in Buffalo, New York today. Abortion rights advocates outnumbered Operation Rescue anti-abortion forces. Stock prices closed lower on Wall Street today, with the Dow Jones Industrials losing 30 points to close at 3336.31. This is NPR News. Ukrainian President Leonid Kravchuk today warned against a proposed independence referendum in Crimea. Kravchuk told the national news agency a referendum could lead to tragedy and bloodshed. Russia gave the Black Sea Peninsula to Ukraine nearly 40 years ago as a gift between two Slav neighbors. Now some Russian lawmakers say the transfer might have been illegal. Leaders of an independence movement in Crimea are gathering signatures to force a referendum on breaking away from Ukraine. The president of Bosnia has accused the Serbian-controlled Yugoslav army of helping Bosnia's Serbian minority seize control of much of the newly independent republic. Pierre Vickery reports that Serbian forces have occupied about 70% of Bosnian territory, although Serbs only make up a third of the country's population.
President Alija Izetbegovic said the capital, Sarajevo, was living in fear of shells and sniper fire. The Bosnian towns were being destroyed and looted, and villages razed to the ground. He accused what he called the murderers of hiding behind the backs of the generals. The president's comments were in reply to an open letter from the Serbian commander of the Yugoslav army in Bosnia, General Kukanjac, who accused the fledgling Bosnian army of attacks on federal defense establishments. Belgrade Radio said two further, mainly Muslim towns in Bosnia had been liberated by Serbian troops. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
The Coast Guard said today it rescued 735 Haitians over the weekend from eight rickety sailboats. The Haitians were brought to the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The refugees say they fear repression from Haiti's new military government that toppled President Jean-Bertrand Aristide last fall. Since October, the Coast Guard has intercepted more than 21,000 Haitians fleeing the country. The U.S. Immigration Service is interviewing Haitians at Guantanamo Bay. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Michael Barson is a pop culture maven who we've called on several times to talk about B-movies and romance comics. You may be familiar with his postcard books. His new book is about what he describes as the pop culture residue of the Cold War, the flotsam and jetsam that shows just how far gone America once was.
Speak English, comrade. Remember, that is about the only freedom you do not have in this town. American town.
Americans, they have too many freedoms.
That is another thing you must remember, comrade. For one day it will be your mission to destroy those bourgeois capitalist freedoms.
That's a scene from Red Nightmare. In the new book, Better Dead Than Red, Michael Barson writes about the pop culture that fueled public hysteria during the height of the Red Scare. Movies like I Was a Communist for the FBI, TV shows like I Led Three Lives, comic books like This Godless Communism, even Red Menace bubblegum cards. He also reprints articles from popular mainstream magazines. In 1943, when the Soviets were our allies in the war, Life magazine ran a special Soviet issue to help acquaint Americans with the Russians. But just 4 years later, Look ran an article called How to Spot a Communist.
The turnabout was dramatic and quick, and one of the funniest things is that there was, in Look magazine, a pro-Stalin piece called A Guy Named Joe, which was also a popular film in 1944 with Spencer Tracy. But A Guy Named Joe, Uncle Joe Stalin, and a look at what a warm-hearted guy he was with, you know, little peasant girls sitting on his knee while he read them stories and talking about his hobbies and so forth. And they used a cover painting to begin the issue in 1944. In 1947, they used the exact same cover painting, and inside is Stalin yet again, but now it's the Soviet Empire and its treachery and you know, its dangers. And the two issues look identical, except they have different dates on them. So, of course, Life and Look were at the top of the journalistic empire at that time. So you're not talking about the National Enquirer here, which probably, had it existed then, would have had its own material. But this is mainstream, respectable American media doing a 180-degree turn.
I feel compelled to read a paragraph from the Look magazine feature, How to Spot a Communist. Because the whole communist apparatus is geared to secrecy, it is not always easy to determine just who is a communist. But whether he is a party cardholder or a fellow traveler, the American communist is not like other Americans. To the communist, everything, his country, his job, his family, takes second place to his party duty. Even his sex life is synchronized with the obligations of the cause. And, of course, the cause is capitalized. But that seems to be a running theme here, that communists have lousy sex lives. And in a lot of the Red Scare movies, you know, women who are like staunch defenders of the party are cold and asexual, whereas women who defect from the party or won't go near the party are more attractive to men.
Well, there is that strain running through there, although many, many, many issues of such magazines as Police Gazette came out with tales about the seductive abilities of the Soviet spies that were female and how they were luring our GIs into betraying America's secrets. And, of course, betraying America's secrets was probably the single most important concern of the day. I mean, that's ultimately what the Rosenberg story was about. But it's true that if you go back to even a friendly film like Ninotchka, you can't get any colder than Garbo is at the beginning of that. And that was our perception, our stereotype of the Russian Soviet character. And, you know, many was the story that they could only be saved by being exposed to the charming wonders of Western democracy and you know, more specifically, us goofy, lovable Americans.
I think we have a film excerpt here that will illustrate one of the points you just made, which is that in some of these Red Scare movies and in some other work as well, it is shown that communist women can lure men with their sexual wiles. And this is a movie called The Red Menace. And in an early scene, a woman in the party lures a man up to her apartment. And when she gets him there, of course, he wants sex, but she wants to talk about the party.
We didn't learn this in the Boy Scouts. Bill, maybe you better go home. Take this along, read it.
So, it's all been just a come on for the party.
Oh, don't say that, Bill.
This is a 1949 movie, The Red Menace. Where does this fit in the Red Scare period after World War II?
Well, 1949 was about as hot as it got. It was just before McCarthy really rose to the power he would assume for the next 3 or 4 years. He was still a year away from really becoming the focal point. But even without Joseph McCarthy, you had a very, very nervous populace here. And one of the things I try to deal with in the book, which is not a very serious look at this subject, I should stress, is that the reason everyone was so nervous was because of what the media was telling them. Now, this movie from Republic Studios was not probably taken seriously by anyone. It came out the same year as an RKO movie called I Married a Communist, and there had been some before it as well, like The Iron Curtain with Dana Andrews. But forget the movies. The editorials in the daily papers, the weekly magazines like the Saturday Evening Post and Life and Look, all of this was sending a message that you could not but help absorb, which was that we were in terrible and imminent danger. And it's just incredible to me, and I would think to most of us now, with the perspective we have of 40 or so years, that everyone could get sucked into this as if it were mass hypnosis or mass hysteria. But this was the case, and you know, there might have been the occasional situation where an actual spy was unearthed somewhere, or some documents changed hands and they actually found who did it. This certainly existed, but the way it was portrayed, it was as if you might at any moment at 3 in the morning wake up to find your bed surrounded by the Russian infantry. That was the mindset of the period.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Barson, and he's an expert on many areas of American popular culture. His new book is called Better Dead Than Red, a nostalgic look at the golden years of Russophobia, red baiting, and other commie madness. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Barson. His new book, Better Dead Than Red, is about red menace pop culture in America. And we've had him on the show several times in the past to talk about B-movies and love comics and other areas of pop culture. What are the Red Scare movies that you'd recommend seeing, either because they're so bad or they're so surprisingly good?
Well, so bad that they're good, I guess, is always my aesthetic. So working from that, I would say that The Red Menace, which has just recently been made available on video, is a wonderful way to start. It has no big stars in it, but don't let that stop you. My Son John, which Paramount put out in 1952 from director Leo McCarey, who had won Oscars for movies like Going My Way, is one of the looniest of these, with Helen Hayes as this totally over-the-top mother who finds out her son is a communist, and Dean Jagger as the father who's an American Legionnaire who would love to take him out into the backyard and give him the thrashing of his life, and the great late Robert Walker as the son who sneers his way through his poor innocent parents until he finally realizes that, just as they'd been telling him, the Communist Party was rotten to the core. Those are two of my favorites. And I Married a Communist from 1949 with Robert Ryan shortly was re-released by RKO under Howard Hughes's directive, and it's more easily found now as The Woman on Pier 13. That is a terrific film, almost a film noir, in fact, but with the communists taking over the docks and the labor unions and some great dialogue. These things just went too far, and they weren't even that successful, really.
Commercially.
Compared to the day's biggest successes. I mean, these were not the number one box office hits, but even a movie that doesn't do that well is seen by millions and millions of people, so I think they probably did have their own effect.
Do you think that the studios made some of these Red Scare movies to get HUAC off their backs?
There's no question about it. They had cooperated in the early 40s doing the pro-Russia films to make the Office of War Information or whatever happy that they were doing their part to rally support for Russia, and they just as quickly had to cover their tracks by putting out the obligatory anti-Soviet film, and you had John Wayne appearing in things like Big Jim McLean and Jet Pilot, where, you know, he was the American set against the commies, and you had Clark Gable. I mean, everybody was in these in one way or another because the studios knew that sooner or later they would be called on to explain what they were doing in 1944, making you know, Song of Russia or the North Star or whatever, and this was the best answer.
So how do you think this Red Scare stuff looks different after the Cold War, after the collapse of the Soviet Union?
Well, I think we can see that we are capable of some very foolish behavior, for one thing. You know, when Eisenhower was asked if he would pardon the Rosenbergs in 1953, just before they were executed for being atomic spies, he was quoted on the front page of the New York Times reporting on the execution. He said, "Absolutely not. They led to the deaths of 10 million people and, you know, essentially good riddance." You know, it was a shocking response and certainly not one of the more comical ones of the time, but it indicates that we did some things that are amazing now with the hindsight of 4 or 5 decades, and you would like to think that we might not give in to that impulse and act that way again, but I think it really is part of the American character, and I think in this book there are laughs to be found. All the material that's in here is real material from different periods, such as we've discussed. But beneath the laughter, there's a veil of tears. I mean, lives were ruined for no reason. The excesses of J. Edgar Hoover have been well documented by many people. Careers never got back to where they were. And just our behavior as a nation was shameful. So although I hope that there are amusing moments experienced here, this isn't really intended to be nothing but yawks, because I think it's also a disturbing part of our national character that we're capable of this. We've done it again and again. We've done it with the American Indian in the past, and we've done it with many other nationalities aside from the nation of the USSR. So that's why there's, a mixed message in this book.
Michael Barson, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Michael Barson's new book about Red Scare pop culture in America is called Better Dead Than Red, and it's published by Hyperion. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll have a story today, Terry, about how American weapons ended up in the hands of the Iraqis, both in the 1980s during the Iran-Iraq War, and how some American weapons ended up in the hands of other countries after the Gulf War. Also, news today of continued violence in South Africa, violence that it seems nobody has sufficient interest in trying to stop. And we'll be talking with a California law journalist about Robert Alton Harris, who is scheduled to be executed in several hours, and about why he apparently is the candidate that the state of California most wants to execute first.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Studs Terkel listens to Americans and shares with us what they have to say. He has a nationally syndicated radio interview program, and he's written oral history books about his hometown, Chicago, the Great Depression, World War II, and people's attitudes about their work. He has a new book called Race, How Blacks and Whites Think and Feel About the American Obsession. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
Studs Terkel is 80 years old this month. So what does he do but publish another book? You have to imagine him in action, on the street, on foot because he doesn't drive, in an old raincoat and battered hat, with a hearing aid and a tape recorder, in pubs or schools or barbershops, or bluffing his way into a housing project on Chicago's Black South Side, sitting down in somebody's kitchen, talking about race. Our premier oral historian is also one of the last of the integrationists, a throwback to Martin Luther King, and before Dr. King, to the left wing of the CIO, and before that, to old-fashioned labor movement socialism and the French Revolution. He's kept the faith by continuing to test it. He'll talk to anybody, and he listens twice, first right there in the kitchen, and then again when he edits the tapes for his books, where intelligence is made somehow musical, where conversations become cantatas. I'm tempted then to call him an oratorio historian. This is what Walt Whitman must have meant when he said he heard America singing. These songs are not all cheerful. Everybody in race, white, black, brown, and yellow, seems to agree that relations among the races are worse today than they've ever been, worse than they were in the 1960s riots. Most blame the go-go greedhead Reagan years and the drug epidemic. Louis Farrakhan gets mentioned more often than I'd have thought imaginable or desirable. As if in counterpoint to Farrakhan, there is also a lot of country blues singer Big Bill Brunsey. But nobody Terkel talks to has given up. Certainly not Emmett Till's mother, Mamie Mobley, who became a teacher after her son was murdered. They have all got jobs to find, and children to raise, and neighborhoods to save, and a nation to recover from its waste of scruple, its conscience gone up in smoke like Puff the Magic Dragon. They are all smarter than anybody I see on television. Where does he find these people? Mostly, but not always, in Chicago. Some, but not most, he's talked to before. Male or female, without exception, it's their working lives that gives them their perspective. They are paramedics, firefighters and flight attendants, carpenters and computer software salesmen, steelworkers, musicians, hairdressers, medical students, hospital aides and chauffeurs, union reps, evangelists, black separatists and Ku Klux Klanners, ex-communists, ex-priests, retired domestics, and many, many teachers, most of them despairing. With each new Terkel book, I make a big deal about this amazing democracy of occupations. Why? Because the brain, too, is a muscle. And it's nice. More than nice, it's thrilling. To see it exercised by people who've never shown up on Face the Nation or Ted Koppel, where all we hear from are the male and the pale, with their credentialed technoblab of underclass and trickle-down, the mellow-speak salesmen in their beltway blister packs, pushing a capital gains tax cut as the miracle cure for moral fatigue, social paralysis, and economic catastrophe. Disappointed, hesitant, or driven as they may be, there's no doubt at all that America would be a better place if everybody listened to these working people, not just radical humanist Studs Terkel, that passionate old man with the brave songs and the magic hearing aid.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Studs Terkel's new book, Race. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Joan Tuohy and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with New York Times reporter Elaine Shalino. She just returned from Iran. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.